afternoon. I'm Stacey Plikta, and I am a professor at the CUNY School of Public Health at Hunter College. My area of research is health services research with a focus on violence against women and how the healthcare system either interacts or doesn't interact with women harmed by violence. And I agree to comply with the American Public Health Association's Conflict of Interest and Commercial Support Guidelines. I can't do this in one breath. And to disclose to participants any off-label or experimental uses of a commercial product or service discussed in my presentation. I have no relevant financial relationships to disclose. Unfortunately, I also have no easy answers to disclose. The addressing of violence against women and the harm it does to health is inherently an intersectoral issue, which makes it really complicated. Intersectoral issues are getting more and more attention. It's a way of framing issues that cross several sectors of society. So particularly when policies in one area, such as law enforcement, affect outcomes in another, or are necessary to affect outcomes in another sector, it makes addressing the issue more complicated. A major goal in intersectoral action is to achieve greater awareness of the health consequences of policy decisions and organizational practice. And I really like this quote, that we should be seeking healthy public policy and practice. So it's not so much about public health policy, it's about healthy public policy, because many public policies that are not health-related, for better or worse, affect the health of the population, and this is just one particular illustration of how that works. Now, intimate violence, which you can think of in the short run as violence sustained by someone known to the person. Intimate violence encompasses child abuse, sexual violence, dating violence, intimate partner violence, and elder abuse. And in a lot of ways, you know, all violence causes harm, but violence that's perpetrated by someone with whom a person has an intimate relationship causes more harm because there's a break of trust. There's also for violence that's ongoing, such as child abuse, dating violence, intimate partner violence, elder abuse, and in many cases, sexual violence, there's an inability to escape the violence. Whereas with stranger violence, if I'm from New York City, so if I'm mugged, the mugger's not going to come back and mug me next week. I have no relationship with the mugger. I don't know them. They haven't violated my trust. And I might be shaken up and physically hurt and need to talk to somebody, but it doesn't cause the amount of tremendous damage that intimate violence causes. And intimate violence is an inherently intersectoral issue because addressing intimate violence involves many sectors of society. So we need legal system intervention, prosecutors, the police, we need social work, private, nonprofit, and advocacy groups play a huge role, healthcare play a role. The problem is there's a little coordination between these agencies, and there's some exceptions that I'll talk about. There's some really good models that are coming up, but they're not institutionalized yet. They're not bureaucratized. They're not the norm everywhere. And so one of the future challenges beyond that is that not only is intimate partner violence intersectoral, but many of the agencies and groups that deal with the different kinds of these violence don't really talk to each other. So there's a whole child abuse world. And you can go to child abuse conferences. We'll hear almost nothing about intimate partner violence and almost nothing about, certainly nothing about elder abuse. There's a whole sexual violence world. There's an anti-rape movement that came out of the 70s at the same time the battered women's movement did. Largely diverged, only in the past 5 to 7 years are those two movements really talking to each other. About a third of all states now have combined agencies, but two-thirds don't. So each of these became its own discipline, and so not only do they have their own advocacy groups, but the laws and policies to deal with each of these kinds of violence are all separate, which, considering how interrelated they are, child abuse puts you at much higher risk for sexual and dating violence and intimate partner violence. Any violence victimization puts you at risk for further. And beyond that, a lot of the needs of the victim survivors are similar, and yet we're so separate and how we deal with it. So I'm going to take just two on that list because the the agencies, the laws, the policies that address intimate partner violence and sexual violence are starting to really move and work together, and there's starting to be some really good models. And it makes sense for these two to come together first because very similar victim survivors, predominantly female, doesn't mean it doesn't happen to males, but there's a lot of the national surveys, the Chaden survey from the National Institute of Justice is probably the best one. This is a gendered crime. Current incidence of IPV and sexual violence is more common in younger women, although lifetime, certainly there's damage sustained over a woman's lifetime that women remember. You know, if they were abused 30 years ago, it can still affect them. It's unclear what effect income, geography, and social class has on risk. Similar outcomes, intimate partner violence and sexual violence, have similar effects on women's health and functioning. Service needs aren't identical, but they overlap a whole lot. There's need for legal intervention. There's need for social services. There's need for advocacy. There's some movement towards coordination. Intimate partner violence and sexual violence is a societal issue. In their lifetime, half of all women will experience abuse, rape, or intimate partner violence. Lifetime prevalence, and you know the numbers vary from 1 in 4 to 1 in 3 for IPV. Annually, about 1.5 million women a year. It used to be well over 2 million women a year, but rates of intimate partner violence are decreasing, and it's probably a real decrease. Risk of rape, lifetime is 1 in 5 to 1 in 4. The annual estimate is around 302,000. About 90,000 of those are reported. That's a really fuzzy statistic, just so you know. The estimates go as high as a million. Because so much of rape is unreported, and it's actually less well-tracked in some ways than intimate partner violence. But the majority of rapes, and this is sort of well-established, between 75 and 80% are by an intimate. The intimate partner violence and sexual violence are certainly public health issues. There's a long list of health risks common to both. The first is death. Two-thirds of all women killed are killed by a male intimate. Injury, disability, traumatic brain injury. I'm not going to read the whole list, but you know, depression, anxiety, poor pregnancy outcomes, and these are shared risks between the two types of violence. Now, the healthcare system, while not is in an interesting position when it comes to helping to address intimate partner violence and sexual violence. Healthcare system is a really important gateway. More women probably seek help from the healthcare system, whether or not they identify as a victim of violence. They'll seek care for injuries, may not state the cause of injury. And it's a primary place that women go and presents opportunities for prevention, but most of what victims and survivors need, they're not going to get from the healthcare system. So the healthcare system largely serves as a gateway, and depending on where you happen to live and what the models are, that's more or less successful or unsuccessful into getting you the care that you need. You know, there's a critical pathway through the healthcare system that includes police, the prosecutor's office, social services, advocacy groups. The problem, of course, is that advocacy is fragmented. The services for intimate partner violence and sexual violence are split. Two-thirds of states and territories have separate advocacy umbrella groups. So the statewide advocacy group for the anti-rape task force for New Jersey, for example, all of the rape crisis centers belong to the statewide advocacy group. They'll hold meetings every so often. They'll coordinate with each other. They'll seek funding together. In some states like Virginia, the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance came together about 7 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. And so there, the rape crisis centers and the domestic violence shelters work together and coordinate and lobby together and know what each other's doing because they're under one umbrella. But the government funding, part of it's driven by funding, you know, and that goes back to public policy. The funding for these groups are largely separate. And again, the majority of what the victims need are outside the healthcare system, and that's part of where the fragmentation is. It's much harder to craft healthy public policy when the policies have to reach legal and advocacy service and housing and social services and others. The public policies are largely not health-centered. Fundings for shelters and IPV programs largely come from Violence Against Women Act, and which is out of the Department of Justice. Prevention funding, marital rape laws, mandatory arrest laws, mandatory report, and I'll talk less about sane forensic programs. And there's one thing to note, and I know I keep saying this, which is It's what we need, but we're not there yet. There are very few formal public policies that promote an intersectoral approach towards intimate violence. Government funding sources, again, Violence Against Women Act is the largest one, but Victim of Crimes Act and CDC prevention grants. The Violence Against Women Act does not come out of a health framework. It comes out of largely a criminal justice framework, although there's certainly funding for some health actions in there. It was authorized in 94, reauthorized in 2000, again in 2005, and it's up for reauthorization this year. This is the key source of funding for programs to help survivors and victims of intimate violence. What happened with healthcare policy was the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force sort of sandbagged it. In 2004, the Preventative Services Task Force found insufficient evidence to recommend for or against routine screening of women. Now, this was only a screening recommendation. Every other medical group, if you look at their policy statements, recommends screening for intimate partner violence. This really, if you look at the funding and the health-centered policies around intimate partner violence, less so sexual violence because sometimes fragmentation works for you, had really a chilling effect on both the funding and implementation of healthcare research and health systems-based interventions that were rooted in public policy. Which is more interesting because the Preventative Task Force Service did recommend that once abuse is detected, coordinated services should be provided. But somehow nobody read the second half of the recommendation. As soon as the recommendation was a level C, recommend either for or against, it became not a priority. And so these statements matter. They set public policy agendas. So a lot of the IPV policies, again, come from criminal justice, come from social services. For intimate partner violence, the majority of program budgets do come from program funding. There were almost no programs in the 70s. There are over 1,900 intimate partner violence programs today. And these provide housing, legal services, court advocacy, and counseling. Most shelters provide inconsistent health services. A lot of shelters, they'll take you to the emergency department. That's the health care plan. Some shelters have relationships with local health care providers or with local free clinics, but it's not their main point. So beyond emergency care, women don't get the health services they need through the shelter system. Now, what's interesting, we talk about effects and unintended effects of policy. The shelters save lives. You know, homicide rates went down from pre to post shelters and have continued to go down. And while most of the studies are small, studies consistently show that shelter stays have a positive effect on physical and mental health of women and children. Simply getting away from the violence results in an almost immediate decrease in depression, which makes sense. There's studies that show longer-term positive effects. But the largest number of lives saved was of abusive men. And so one of the effects of the shelters, which is a good thing, you know, we do want to prevent homicide in public health, the presence of shelters largely promoted, the largest decline was in intimate homicides of males of African American males, and to a lesser extent, a reduced homicide of victimization of other males. And so the thinking is that women who were trapped in abusive relationships sometimes killed their partners because it was their only way out. Once they had a shelter to go to, once there was somewhere else they could go rather than commit a homicide, they had somewhere else, they had a safety valve, they had a way to escape. So this was not an effect that anybody saw, but, you know. Another effect, and though this one wasn't so positive, the mandatory arrest laws were a criminal justice move. And the idea behind mandatory arrest laws were that if a police officer comes on the scene and a woman's been abused, if the abuser's there and she's afraid of him, and she's cowering or she's injured, she's not going to, and the police officer says, do you want me to arrest him, ma'am? Well, if she says yes, he's out the next day. He's out the next day, what is he going to do? He's going to come back and beat her again. So rather than putting, the initial intent of this law was great, rather than putting the onus on the woman to press charges, the police officers were directed, if you come and there's an intimate partner violence incident, you make the arrest, it's mandatory. Well, what happened is women started getting arrested. So women would be defending themselves. Police officer comes, two people are fighting. It doesn't matter that he's beating her and she's being defensive when you look at the context of the violence. All the officer sees is two people fighting and they both get arrested. So this was an unintended negative consequence of this law. For intimate partner violence, I know my time is short, so I'm going to skip through towards the end here. There are a few coordinated responses. There's something called domestic violence response teams, but there aren't a lot of them. They're not well evaluated. I could not find any good data on their number or effectiveness, and they're pretty new. What actually is a really good model for an intersectoral approach to intimate violence are the sexual assault nurse examiner programs and the sexual assault response teams, which tend to overlap because almost all sexual assault nurse examiner programs are members of a SART or serve as a SART if there's no SART in the area. And these have only been around since 1992. But since 92, they've grown tremendously. Forensic nursing, sexual assault nursing is now a specialization which people train for. And what they do is they explicitly seek to coordinate services between all of the different entities that need to interact to assist a woman who's been a victim of sexual violence. So there's roughly 300 SARTs in the United States, and they typically include the emergency department forensic staff, the police, the prosecutor's office, the rape crisis center, social work, and other community agencies. That varies, but the first five are almost always there. Sexual assault nurse examiner programs are more currently referred to as forensic nursing programs. They're usually hospital-based. There's over 450 in the United States, which sounds like a lot until you realize there are 5,000 hospitals in the United States. So it's like, okay, great. So in about 5% of hospitals, women, if they present as the victim of sexual violence, have access to a forensic nurse examiner program, but the other 95% don't. And they're concerned with both victim care and, sorry, 10%, not 5. They're concerned with both victim care and evidence gathering. So the sexual assault nurse examiner programs serve both the health care needs of the woman and the evidentiary gathering needs of the attorney's office, of the prosecutor's office. The evaluations there have not been extensive, but where they've been evaluated consistently, forensic nurses do superior evidence gathering, provide much better coordinated patient care, better services to victims, and better criminal justice outcomes. So these teams work because they gather people from all of the different sectors, have them working towards a common goal. So big picture overview of my last two slides. There were no intimate partner domestic violence policies prior to the 1970s, and now we're coming on the fourth reauthorization of Violence Against Women Act. Part of what happened there is the original movements, both domestic violence and anti-rape, were grassroots advocacy movements, and they largely shifted to some sort of more bureaucratic social service government-funded movements, which is good in some ways because they're more stable and have better resources, but it's not good in other ways because the advocacy function's been reduced. There's still a great lack of coordination among groups and services for different types of intimate violence. There's certainly almost no coordination for child abuse, elder abuse, along with these others. And there's still a lack of coordination between sectors. Certainly the sexual assault response teams are a great model, but we need to start moving towards them. VAWA has been really successful, just that these policy efforts matter. In the 15 years since the Violence Against Women Act was first inaugurated, we've had major shifts in societal attitudes towards violence against women, increases in service availability. While it's not where it needs to be, there is better coordination of sectors, there is a decrease in intimate partner violence, and there is decreased homicide rates. And future directions. We need to really work towards a fully comprehensive intersectoral response to violence. And we need to better coordinate between the different agencies that serve the different people victimized by different types of violence. And the SARTs and the SANE programs probably provide the best models that we have. But while we're doing this, we need to evaluate our efforts and watch for unintended consequences. Okay. Thank you.